All right, everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Money Seat. Thanks again for joining. Today's guest is Allie. And without further ado, Allie, why don't you introduce yourself so the audience could get to know you a little bit better?
Sure. So I'm 32. I'm married and I have one kid and another one on the way.
Oh, congrats on that.
Yeah, it's exciting. So I have a master's in public health and epidemiology, and I've worked as an epidemiologist for a while in various fields. I currently work in the cancer field, and I run the cancer registry for the state. So.
And where did you go to college?
Oh yeah, I went to the Ohio State University. Played soccer there.
You did. You played Division I soccer there. Yeah. All 4 years?
Yeah, all 4 years. I was injured a bit, but yeah.
Did you have any plans on playing further once you finished school, or that was kind of it for you?
No, that was it for me. I did play like a little bit of amateur.
Okay.
And I played a little bit of like semi-professionally abroad when me and my husband lived in Israel for 2 years, so I played a little bit there as well. I've done a bit, but no, I never really had aspirations past college. That's my high level.
Well, no, that's pretty high level. Awesome. And where do you guys currently live? Where do you and your husband currently live now?
Oh, yeah, we live in Oklahoma right now. We live in a suburb of Oklahoma City.
Okay. Perfect. Well, thank you very much. Congrats on the expecting child. How far along are you?
Currently, I am 13 weeks.
13 weeks. Okay. So you got
a bit of time.
Okay. A bit of time. All right. Well, congrats on all that. Thanks for joining me again today. And I'm sure you're excited to ask some questions that I am unprepared to answer. So without further ado, why don't you start with question one?
Sure. So my first question would probably be about saving for college.
Okay.
So we've already started, and we have like family who's also, you know, like for birthdays or other events have said that they are also helping in their own ways. But so my question is, between, like, I haven't started a 529,
okay,
which I know is like the college savings kind of account,
yeah,
that gets tax benefits. So I was kind of wondering like the difference in using a 529 versus like currently I just have like a custodial account that we have money in and we're investing in it. So yeah, kind of the differences and the pros and cons and yeah. What
do
you thought?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good question and something a lot of people who recently have kids are thinking about. Even at a young age, they're already worried about how to pay for college. So yeah, that's a very good question. I would say this has changed a lot in the last 10, 15, 20 years with 529 being introduced and with the rising costs of college education. A 529 right now is the most popular way to save. And a few reasons why is that it has a lot of great tax benefits. That's really the main difference between the two. And a lot of it depends on the state you live in. I wish I could tell you Oklahoma. I'm not familiar with Oklahoma, but I could give you an example of Illinois. So Illinois will give you a direct tax deduction on your state taxes up to $10,000 that you contribute per person. And if you're married, you would get $20,000. So they'd add it together. So for example, if you contributed $20,000 to a 529 plan and lived in the state of Illinois, you would get a 5% tax break based on that's what their income tax is on that, or $1,000 back in your taxes. So that's pretty nice rebate right there. In addition, let's say Oklahoma doesn't have that, or you live in a state where they don't allow a 529 plan deduction for their state taxes. the big benefits is growth over time. So how old did you say your son was?
I didn't. He's 2.5.
He's 2.5. Okay. So that means you'd be putting money in now, and it would be in there for a long period of time before you took anything out. And so the benefits of the 529 plan is if you put it in to the account and all the money that grows, none of it gets taxed as long as you take it out and use it for qualified college expenses. So tuition, books, maybe he goes to grad school, maybe he gets an advanced degree. All of those can be used for your son without paying any taxes, which is obviously a huge deal in investments. Because anytime you could, maybe you put $10,000 in and it grows to 30, that's $20,000 you don't have to pay taxes on. And over time, that could be very helpful. In addition, a benefit of the 529 plan is, let's say your son becomes a great soccer player and he gets the soccer scholarship to Ohio State, and you don't have to spend money on him to go to school. You could transfer that 529 plan to your other son or daughter, and they could use it for their college expenses as well. So it's transferable between kids. Let's say your kid decided not to go to school for whatever reason, or you didn't need it for college. You could always take the money out, and you just would have to pay taxes and penalties on it, but it wouldn't be like lost forever. Some people are worried that if they don't spend the money on college, they won't ever get to use it. And in contrast, the custodial account, while helpful, you're going to have to pay taxes along the way, which will obviously eat into its returns, and there won't be those tax benefits and, special treatments when you take it out in the future. They also recently passed a law, which each states have adopted differently, that you can also use 529 plans for K through 12 education at private schools as well, for qualified expenses. So depending on if you were going to send your kid to a private school, you can use those funds to pay for those, which are not cheap. So hopefully that answers your questions on those.
Yeah, can I ask a follow-up?
Absolutely, question? Yeah. That's the more the better.
So we move around a lot.
Yeah.
As a professor, mm-hmm. So it didn't make sense for me, I think, to open up an Oklahoma 529 if, say, we were going to move in 2 years.
Okay.
So is it transferable to another state, or how does that
work? That is a great question. I apologize for not addressing that originally. So, yeah, it doesn't matter what state you live in, or what state your kid goes to school, you can open an Oklahoma plan and be in Illinois, and he can go to school in California. The only difference would be is if Oklahoma has a special like tax rebate on it, you might not get it if you don't use the state's plan. But other than that, the tax treatments of the growth and how you can use it doesn't matter which state's plan you use. So for instance, Illinois used to not have a great 529 plan. So people who lived in Illinois, even though they wouldn't get the tax benefits, used like an Ohio plan or a Virginia plan that were better, because they'd rather have a better performing plan than one that gave them the tax breaks. So
the tax breaks when they put the money in.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Which is, like I said, for Illinois is the 5% income tax, but every state is different, so I couldn't speak on that. But those are usually small and minimal compared to the tax break over time of all that growth, right. If that makes sense. So yeah, you could start one in Oklahoma, and you can move to Nevada and transfer it to Nevada's plan as well, and then move again to Florida or Oregon and move it and keep transferring it to the different states' plans, just so you know. There's no fees, there's no penalties, there's not an issue to do that. You can move it around if you want. Yeah, so yes, and they do that because they don't want to deter people like you who move around from saving for their kids' college, right? But that's a great question, because a lot of people have that worry. That if they move, they won't get to use the money. There's different types of college savings that aren't 529 plans that have those rules, but 529 plans don't, which is why they're so popular for people to use. Okay.
Some places, do they offer putting money directly from your paycheck into a 529 tax-free, or is it, it's a post-tax
thing? Yeah, it's going to be a post-tax thing, like a Roth IRA or an F, but the company, it depends on the company. So some companies can set that up as a benefit for their employees.
I work for the state, so I know that we have.
Yeah. So that's great. I would recommend definitely doing that. But just so you know, most people don't have that benefit, actually. But yes, you could. And it's a great thing to do, but it would be post-tax.
I would, you get your rebate no matter what.
Yeah, I would look it up after this to see what Oklahoma's specific state laws are on 529 plans. But yes, I know you could put it in directly post-tax, and that would be a great thing for your son.
Thanks.
Perfect. Question number two.
Okay, so kind of switching gears to more like retirement stuff. Okay. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on, so like having both a traditional IRA and a Roth IRA.
Mm-hmm.
So I know like previously I was advised that like it was probably about 2/3, 1/3. How much you should put in, whatever, for growth, because obviously a Roth is not taxed in the end.
Mm-hmm.
But that there's been some changes in the laws now. And I mean, who knows what it's going to be in like 35 years when I retire. But
right.
Just like your thoughts on like how much you should be proportionally adding to your traditional IRA versus like a Roth IRA.
Yeah.
And, like, long-term tax implications of that?
That is a great question. And the answer to that is the unfortunate, it depends on your situation.
Okay.
So the reason why I say that is it first depends on if you work for a company that has their own 401k. And if they do, how much you're contributing to that. Because it's important to add that to the ratio that you're discussing. So if you work for a government organization and they have a 401k, it sounds like you work for a company that does have one, correct?
Yeah, they actually have both, like a 403b and a 401k.
Okay. So 403b is just the same thing, but for like a government or for a...
Maybe just 457.
Four fifty seven is government. 403b would be like my parents who are professors. They have a 403b because they work for... Yeah.
I have a 457 and they offer like a 401k.
Yeah.
And they do like 4% on one and then 2% on the other.
Right. So yeah. So they're matching, they're putting money in. I assume you're contributing some percentage, right, to it. Yeah. So that means you're already putting money away to the traditional IRA side, which I lump those all in because they just have the same tax treatments as in you get the benefit now and you pay for it later. And as opposed to the Roth, where not all companies have Roth 401ks and they'll never match on a Roth side. So even if you put money in a Roth, it won't get matched. So in order to get money into the Roth side of things, you really have to open up your own, for the most part, your own account and do it yourself. The other reason why I ask your situation is there's actual income laws about putting money in a traditional IRA and a Roth. So if you're single and you make a certain amount of money, or married and make a certain amount of joint money, once you hit a certain income, you're not allowed to contribute to a traditional IRA unless you and your husband don't have a 401k or don't have a plan at work. But in your situation, you do, which makes your income limit very low. I think for married couples, it's like in the low hundreds combined income. So most people, they can't contribute to that regular IRA at all. So they don't even have the option to do so, which is why they put money in a Roth. And it just ends up being that 60-40, 70-30 split you discussed based on the math of what you can contribute, to be honest. Okay. The Roth income limits are much higher, and there's ways around it. So for instance, for me, I put money in a 401k and then I max out my Roth. I think for young people, having the compounding interest over 20 or 30 years is very powerful to not pay taxes on. So I like the Roth. I maximize my Roth at the beginning of every year Because I'm a little like I'm a little nerdy about that, but that's what I do.
And we do it at the end of every year, like before April 15th.
Yeah, and I do it for the next year, the beginning. It's like, ooh, Happy New Year, time to make my Roth IRA contributions. It's like a very exciting point in my life. But yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because you do have until the April 15th tax deadline. So yeah. Right now, the tax deadline's coming up for in April of 2021. You can make that contribution on April 15th for previous year's 2020. So it's important for people to know you have some time, even if you miss it. But it's important, like you said, to find a balance. And based on your income, your work's benefits, you, if you're married and all that. So there's a lot of factors and variables, right, that go into that. And your age. And so it's a little more complicated than just kind of looking at the percentages. But I do think everyone should have some going to one place and some going to the other and not put all their eggs in one kind of tool.
What's the downside? So I do have both. And,
yeah.
And well, like, okay, so right now, as far as I understand it, the laws that they change, it's like once you retire, you actually have to take out a certain percentage of one of them or both. I don't know. But obviously, as you get older, that percentage takes out more of the money at a time.
Yeah. So you asked about the new laws. So they're about RMDs or required minimum distributions. And that applies to an IRA. If you're still working and you have a 401k or a 403b and you hit that age, you don't have to take it out. But if you have your own IRA, it used to be 70 and a half. You turn 70 and a half, they would take the value of your portfolio at year end and they would divide that by your age would have like a factor. So if you're 70, it would be like 26, and then if you're 71, it would be like 26 and a half, and it keeps going up and up, which means, right. So anyways, they moved that back from 70 and a half to 72, which is a big deal. And because of COVID, they actually got rid of RMDs for 2020. That's obviously a temporary thing that won't be for us. Yeah. But because people are living longer, they're working later, there's a good chance that for people like us who are younger, that might be moved again in the next 30 years. I don't know. But yeah, that's a reason why Roths are powerful because they don't have any rules.
It's just the traditional.
Yeah, because the reason why is you defer taxes on it. You haven't paid taxes on that income and the government wants their money and they're going to get it from you one way or another. So the Roth, they've already gotten their taxes. It's after tax money. So they don't really care what you do with it because they already got their money. Or they have less rules about that. So that's why it's important to have both. And the reason why I say this is, let's say you're in your, I don't know, you're in your mid 60s. And you know, traditional IRA, traditional IRAs aren't the best tools to pass on to as an inheritance because they have those taxes, they have rules, you have to take a certain amount out. And a lot of money you think you have in your $1 million IRA, you know, 30% can end up going to the government. So it's like it feels like you have more wealth than you do. So it's important to have another tool that doesn't have taxes to take it out or pass it on to other heirs and inheritance, which I know is crazy to think about, but
right. It makes sense. It just makes me feel like you should like only contribute to a Roth.
Well, you should contribute the maximum, which if you're under 50 is 6,000 and over 50 is 7,000. But as you know, that's not enough money to contribute. That's going to help you a little bit, but that's not enough to retire on. Let's be honest. So you need money to go somewhere else. And it's also nice to have tax benefits now, to be honest. If you're a higher earner and you're making enough where you're in a 30, 35, 40% tax bracket, you want that break now because that's big as opposed to the future where who knows what's going to happen. So that's why it's a balancing act, depending on your income, your age, all that stuff. Most people who are, you know, in a 24% bracket, it's 50-50, if that makes sense. And then there's a tipping point, and they just changed the tax code a few years ago. And now with the new president and new members of Congress, they might change it again. So I would say this is an ever-evolving thing that's good to make sure you're up to what the new laws are, because it changes how you would invest is my best recommendation for that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks.
Perfect. Question three, because that was like 2A, B, and C, right?
I know. Well, it's okay. I might only have like four.
So that's perfect. Then we'll count that two and three.
I guess it kind of is similar. It's maybe a shorter question, mm-hmm. but like, what would you say for like a 30-ish year old, early 30s? Like what should your retirement goals be in terms of like how much you should be saving? I mean, I know it depends on your lifestyle.
Yeah.
So we have a pretty modest lifestyle.
Yeah.
Not very, we don't spend a lot, but like what are good retirement goals for
That's a good question. I'm going to say, what's a good retirement goal for someone in exactly in your shoes? Early 30s, has a kid, another one on the way, married, and probably a great example of middle America at that age. So it depends on a few factors. I usually say savings isn't necessarily a number. Like, I'm not going to say save $10,000 a year or else, because that's not accurate. But it's more of a percentage. And it should be a percentage of your income, of your gross income, you and your husband, and reflect your goals and your lifestyle. So if you live a modest lifestyle and you guys think you'd like to continue that and you don't need anything lavish for retirement, then that should affect your saving strategy. In addition, if you and your husband say, we're done working by the time we hit 60, and that's not negotiable, we need to be saving more aggressively, right? So some of it depends on those goals, which is very hard for people in their 30s to know, right? Because it's so far away. So I would ask you, have you thought about some of those things and have ideas on them yet?
About specifically when to retire. I mean I don't anticipate in like retiring early, which I know 60 is not that early, but it's considered retiring.
It's early.
I would imagine that's not gonna be us, and especially like my husband, like he's a professor, so he probably will not retire.
Right, that's true. Yeah, they don't retire early. Yeah.
Because it's a pretty easy-ish job to have as you age, and actually it's a pretty stable.
Yes, yeah.
So I imagine we wouldn't be retiring on the near side of the 60s, at least for sure not him. I've heard ballpark figures of like by the time we're that age to maintain a lifestyle, like $4 to $5 million.
So once again, I would say that's probably a little high unless you had goals of leaving, a lot of money to kids or charitable causes or other people, right? Unless you had dreams of having vacation homes and, retiring in Manhattan or San Francisco, right, where the cost of living is very high. But otherwise, I would say that with Social Security somewhat being there, you both having government and teaching and education jobs, those end up having very good retirement benefits in themselves in terms of pensions, in terms of contributions, in terms of what they do for people. So you're not someone who would be maybe as reliant on building up a nest egg as someone like me, who is in an industry where, I don't have a match from a company. It's just me. So I'm more reliant on building my own wealth. So I would say, a number is hard to really say yes or no. Really a savings goal would be 10 to 20%, I tell for most people, of their gross income, they should be putting away to some type of retirement. And that's their 401k, that's the match. You add all that together and it should be at least 10 or 20%. Personally, after talking to you, you guys don't have these lavish, crazy retirement goals that you need to be doing something more aggressive than the average people. And just know that 10 to 15 is about the recommended average. And if you start at a young age, you should be able to hit that because you know, 30 is pretty young to actually start building up net worth. I would say
I'll have to tell Jesse that because he thinks that it's late.
No. I would say
having gone through like a PhD and a post, basically there's been like no income.
Yeah, I get that. But trust me, it's not late. Once again, unless you had very lavish or aggressive retirement goals, but you don't, right? I mean, if Jesse wanted to go be an owner of the Chicago Bears, this would be a different conversation, right? If he wanted to have a private yacht and, you know, have a vacation, right? But it sounds like that's not the case. So because that's not it, no, it's not too late. I would say I've only worked with a few people where I realistically had to tell them, I don't know if it's too late, but we have to change the realistic goals we have. And those people are in their late 50s and early 60s. You could always, even in your 40s, start from scratch. And if you're really disciplined and focused, you can get to where you want to go in the next 20 years, I would say.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you guys started now with nothing, I would still say, hey, you set up a plan, be disciplined, stick to it, and you'll be able to get where you want in 20 to 30 years. Absolutely.
That's helpful. I'll make sure to let him know.
Yeah. Yes. But it's not easy. You definitely have to stay disciplined and
he's not starting from nothing. But, you
know. Yeah, I know. But I get it. Like, I get it. Because, because a lot of people, they get their advanced degrees, they go through schools, they rack up debts, and they start later than their friends.
You don't get paid that much.
Right. Right. And you feel like you're behind the eight ball. But once again, it's not like that when you're this young. It's harder, especially if you're going to have another kid and you have to allocate expenses toward the 529 plan and college and other things. But once again, obviously not impossible. So I would say tell Jesse it's to be optimistic and that number would be great to hit, but he doesn't have to hit that to reach his goals. Yeah.
Actually, it just reminded me of another good question. So when you have a second kid, would you do a second 529 or is it just one?
Absolutely. And the reason why is as they get older, you're going to adjust the portfolio. And if they'll be about 3 years apart, right now it might not look too different, but over time it will. Also, to be honest, your kids are going to want to know you have two accounts, one for each of them. Let's just be honest.
I assumed yes.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't do a huge amount of benefits or negatives just for those things I said. So why not just open another one and have that separate goal? And like I said, when they hit like high school, you're going to scale the investments much differently as they get closer. Right. And being 3 years apart is a huge deal. Later on.
$20,000 per year, is that total or is that per kid?
Per kid. And
per 529.
Yeah, and that was just the state of Illinois for the right. You could contribute more. I think it's like $200,000 or $200,000 per person you could put in an account.
Per year.
Yeah, I mean, I think it might be total per person per kid. So if you had
okay.
So you could, over the lifetime of the 529 account, you and Jesse could theoretically put $400,000 in there. Wealthier people do use this as a tool, especially if their kids are going to private schools or going to be going overseas, right? It actually ends up, the stuff is expensive. So it's not crazy to think you might need $250,000 over the lifespan of your kid's education. So,
For sure.
That's the rule. It's very loose. They really encourage it. To go back to that question, they encourage, the rules are very friendly because they want people to put money in their kids to save for college, which is great. I'm glad that they did that.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, thanks.
Was that number, that was it?
I had like another kind of question. It was more just like about passive income and like investing in like real estate type stuff. Like I've never done it. It's always like been on my mind, but I don't know how I would even think about that.
Yeah. You know? So that's a good question. By that, so for passive income, do you specifically mean real estate income or just any type of passive?
Like whatever passive. You think is like good ways to earn passive income. Obviously it's nice to have.
Yeah. I would say that when it comes to passive income, it's always good to be knowledgeable in what you're doing. So I always say real estate is great, and and, you know, seeing them what they do on TV and making it look so simple and easy and profitable is awesome. But I always kind of caution people to not just jump into something without fully understanding what they're doing, how it works and everything. So I would say real estate would be great if you knew someone, if you had an expert, if you kind of had some advanced knowledge on it. I always caution people to get into this stuff as a novice and with too much money. So first of all,
that's very involved.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't always have to be, you know, people sometimes use, a second job as passive income. They'll like drive for Uber and consider that some passive income. But to be fair, it's easier said than done for a lot of this stuff. Like I said, the real estate stuff is passive, but you have to work hard. You have to know what you're doing to make money for the most part. So it's not just a la 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 la, I'll do this a little bit and make some money. If it was that simple,
your first house,
yeah,
and then, you know, 5 years later you buy a second house, but you're able to rent out your
first house. That's absolutely passive income. And that would be very like low key, low risk passive income. And I think that's probably something that you'd be interested in doing.
You can live somewhere where you can buy two houses.
Maybe. Yeah. Oklahoma. Yeah. Yeah.
Oklahoma's possible. Yeah.
Yeah. Out here in Seattle, it's cost of living's too high. Houses. Yeah. It's too much money to do that. But yeah, I would say, once again, you do some research, you know what you're doing, what you're buying, finding the right people to maybe landlord and manage the property and outsource that stuff. And so it doesn't take up all your time, because remember, passive is supposed to be passive. And I think that'd be a good thing to look into. It's not something I currently do too much. A lot of my clients, to get passive income, usually just invest in like dividend paying stocks in the market. And
yeah. It's, oh, is that considered passive? Okay.
Yes and no. I mean, you're investing money in the market and it's making money without you doing anything. But it's not like, it's not like other things where you might be getting higher returns. You know, dividends are usually 3 to 5%. So it's very low risk, but lower return passive income for people who don't want to take that. And you have to still have excess money. Because, you know, $1,000 of a stock isn't going to, you know, you might need five or 10.
Money to make money.
Yeah. It, unfortunately, passive income does require some of that as well. You know, I would say like art, some people do that, but art is not really passive income. It's more like alternative investing. And that's a different, right? People invest in like private equities and real estate and hedge funds. And that's more like alternative investing than passive income, which requires just more money and stuff. But yeah, it's always good to look into. And if you find anything you're passionate about that you think you could do, I would encourage you to do that, as long as you knew the risks involved.
For sure.
Yeah. Cool. That's a good question. Nice. All right. That was number five. So I'm going to have to cut you off, Allie.
Sounds good.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for joining me on the Money Seat. I appreciate your time. And it was great to get to know you and talk a little about you and your life and your family and some of your goals. And hope you had a good time here on the Money Seat.
Well, yeah, thanks for the free advice.
it's a good point. Anytime. Thanks for joining us, fans, and hopefully we'll see you on the next episode of the Money Seat. Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professionals prior to making a decision. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful.